Good morning.
Good morning,
Sensei. Good morning,
Sensei. I wasn't here last week because I went to a Dharma transmission. Now, the word Dharma has several meanings, but in this case, the word Dharma means teaching. And so a Dharma transmission is when a teacher makes a student a new teacher. And that process, teacher making a student a new teacher, is called the Dharma transmission. And it's really a very beautiful ceremony. And just to get a feeling for it, I'll just say a couple of brief things. It starts out, the room is full, and all of, or just about all of, Roshi Kennedy's Dharma successors are there and were wearing robes. And so the teacher and the student come in, followed by attendants. The attendants help the teacher and the student as it go through the ceremony. And so there's this loud drum, you know, so it makes it very dramatic. And so they enter and they go up before the altar. And there's a variety of ceremonies, which is a lot of detail, which I won't go into, but I'll mention a couple of things. The word is called lineage. And lineage is, it goes all the way back to Buddha, right? And it's about the transmission. So this teacher passed the teaching on to this teacher, and this teacher, and this teacher, throughout history up until the present day. Now that's ceremonially. It's not literally true because there's a lot of teachers, women in particular, who get left out of this lineage chart. But it's really impressive in the sense that there are Japanese teachers, there are Chinese teachers, and there are American teachers. And so there are this list of all these teachers through time. And so it starts with the Chinese teachers. And Amy Yi, who is a student of Roshi's, who is Chinese, chants all the Chinese names in Chinese. And then, I didn't know the fellow that did this, but then there was a fellow who chanted all the Japanese names. And then finally there was another woman who chanted the American lineage holder. And then, as this ceremony goes through, there comes a point where there's the actual transmission. And up to this point, the teacher, who is a woman, I do not remember her name, I didn't know her before Sunday, she comes dressed in white. So at a certain point in the ceremony, the actual transmission takes place. And the teacher says something, and then the student answers what the teacher says. The teacher says something else. The student answers that, and there's this back and forth. And then after that's complete, that's sort of the last testing of the student. You know, the teacher asks challenging questions of the student, and so the student responds. And then when that's done, and this is the most moving part, is one of the attendant for the student carries out, I don't usually wear them here, but carries out this black robe. It's a full robe, and there's, I forget the name of it, but it goes around the neck and down, stole, and it's white and silver. So the attendant comes out and dresses, puts the robe on the student with the stole. And that's emblematic of the transmission. When the teacher takes the robes for the first time, that person, that student, has now become a teacher, has now received Dharma transmission. And then there are several other things. And, this goes on for about 45 minutes, so I can't describe all the different individual things. But it should give you a feeling of the essence of how this works. So that has nothing to do with my talk, but it explains where I was. Well, actually, it does have to do with my talk. I'm sorry, I take that back. So while I was there, I got to talking to this young fellow. And in this conversation, I might have even said, "So how are you?" And he said, "I'm bummed out. I think I'm depressed." And so he doesn't really tell me why, but he tells me that he's thinking of going to darshan, which is a form of an interaction between an Indian teacher and a student. It sort of refers to seeing the light by meeting the teacher under the circumstances that this happens. The student allows the student to see the light. And the actual ceremony is, I don't think I've ever seen it, but the student will sit down like this here in front of the teacher and will lower their head. And the teacher, in this case, Mother Meera, who's a famous Indian guru, will take the person's head in both her hands. And this becomes a very energetic connection. You know, the common term is raising of the kundalini, but it's a pretty powerful experience. And then the person sits back up and they look each other in their eyes. And again, this is a very powerful connection. And this is sort of, I think, in what little I know about the Indian tradition, is sort of the heart of it. A lot of the Indian tradition is based on energy and connecting through energy. And so what this does is it gives the person, this is how they see it, the person the energy, purification, and inner healing, or whatever is required for their mental health, and whatever is required for their emotional health and their physical aspects as well. So the three of those things function in harmony. And so because he was suffering from depression, he was talking to me about going to Germany, where Mother Meera teaches. And he said, well, you know, I asked him, how long has it been? He said, 6 months. And he said, I think it's time to go back. And so I asked him, you know, so what was the experience like? And he said, it was a wonderful high. So, or splendid high is what he said. So that he was going back to, after 6 months, the original high had worn off, and now he was going back to get recharged, as he referred to it as getting recharged. So I said to him, so how does this work? You also have a daily practice. And he said, no, I don't. It's too hard to maintain. I find it's better to just every 6 months go and get recharged. But it was interesting to me, you know. I don't really know much about that. And it was interesting having this conversation. But it also started me thinking about the student-teacher relationship, particularly in this lineage, in the Zen lineage. And so there's a well-known Zen teacher, Chinese Zen teacher named Huang Bo. And he famously said, there are no Zen teachers. And so this takes place in a temple, and so there are monks there. And he says, there are no Zen teachers. And so this is the way, these, for you who are new, these interactions always happen like this, and they're always really intended to be a teaching. So again, he says, there are no Zen teachers. So a monk says, teacher, master, there are Chinese teachers all over China. There are temples all over China. How can you say there are no Zen teachers? And Huang Bo just sits there for a few seconds quietly. And he says, I said there are no Zen teachers. I didn't say there is no Zen. So very similar to this, Dogen, these are some famous words from Dogen, which is, we don't practice to attain enlightenment. We practice because we are already enlightened, right? We don't practice to attain enlightenment, which means we don't practice to get something. And that's because we already have. We already embody what we need. So if there is nothing to attain and we already have what we seek, why should we have a teacher? Why should we sit? Why should we go to retreat? Right? We already have it. And so the way that I would answer this question is that Zen is not about attainment. It's about revelation. It's about revealing this which we embody, the enlightenment which we already have. Right? So we practice to reveal this, not to get something. So there are a lot of barriers from making the connection to who we really are, this essence of ourselves that the practice is to reveal. And so these barriers come in many forms. But they, as I said, they keep us from getting in touch with our true selves. And so just to give some examples, the barriers that we create, right? We create or we absorb from circumstances. And so these occur from what we tell ourselves about the life we live, the words and thoughts that we have about these things. Our culture transmits things that become barriers. Our families, or interaction with our families, create things that become barriers. Our religions create barriers. Again, the accumulation of ideas, the desires we have, the feelings we have, the philosophies we attach to, the judgments we make, like or dislike, all of this is a pile of stuff that we carry in our heads, which every time we have an experience, all of those things filter that experience, right? It shapes the experience. And because it does that, we don't have the direct experience of who we already are. Now, my own experience about this was, which I didn't really know until I started to do this practice and started to go to retreats, but I was at, this is many years ago, and I was at a week-long retreat, and somewhere around the fourth or fifth day, a lot of these ideas, these constructs that I had, the way in which I defined who I was, right? All these ideas, all of what culture told me who I was, what my religion told me who I was, all of these things started to soften. They started to melt in a sense. And this revealed for me, these things were not so much the barrier. The barrier was that I was terrified to let go of who I thought I was. And I left. I couldn't bear the fear that I experienced. So that fear of letting go of all these things that I'm talking about is a barrier. It was my barrier. And so in this particular situation, I realized that this had a lot to do with my childhood experience, you know, and I had, that experience had created, for example, protections that I used as a child to protect myself. But now these were melting away, so I was terrified because I cling to those things. So the way that I dealt with that, I realized I had to go back and do psychotherapy to help with those things so that I could proceed in my practice. But that's a personal example of a very specific barrier that I needed to work with and how I became aware of it. Now, I'm going to tell this story. It's an old story. It's a child story. But I hope that it gives some meaning, in a sense, to what I'm talking about. And, of course, it's a metaphor. So it's about the ugly duckling story. How many of you have heard the story of the ugly duckling? Oh, my goodness. Well, you're about to. Brace yourself. But I'm not the ugly duckling, just so you know. So the ugly duckling saw herself as very different from her brother and sister ducklings. And, you know, her neck was too long. Her color was different. She made different sounds. And because she was different, the other ducklings made fun of her. Of course, she felt alone, and she felt angry, and she felt despondent, and wondered even why is life worth living? She felt that much apart from the other ducklings, and she felt about herself that she was ugly and undesirable. And so one day, the mama duck rounds them all up and brings them down to the pond. And as this ugly duckling enters the pond, she catches a glimpse of herself, and we might say in Zen terms, her true self. She sees this beautiful swan who had already had everything she needed, but she had deceived herself into thinking she was ugly. So she was actually a beautiful swan. Now, remembering that this is a metaphor, so there was no teaching, no belief system, or no philosophy that the swan could have substituted for this direct experience. Those things were useless. But that direct experience of seeing her reflection in the water, that's who I am. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about these barriers, all these ideas of who we think we are. So to go full circle, if there are so many teachers and so many sanghas throughout the world, right? So many Zen teachers and so many Zen sanghas throughout the world, and also other Buddha teachers. There's teachers in all these different lineages. Right? And there's a saying, which is that wisdom has no teacher. So what's the point? Why do we have Dharma transmissions? Why does the teacher make new teachers if there are no teachers? So I think it has to do with understanding really what a teacher means. And the way that I would answer this question is that we don't have teachers to pass on knowledge, philosophy, morality, peace of mind, all these things that we chased after. What we really have teachers for is to create a climate, a place, a container that makes it safe for us to reveal who we are, makes it supportive of us to reveal who we are. So we're not looking to get something from the teacher. We're looking to have a place that we can go, sit down with the teacher that's safe enough to allow us to realize who we really are. And so the teacher creates this container. But it's not just the container of the individual meeting of the teacher, the relationship of with the teacher. It's also the way the Zendo is run. It's also the way we're encouraged to relate to each other as a Sangha. And it's also a way of the attention that we pay to the bowing and the other rituals which go on here. And all of that creates a place that encourages revelation, supports revealing ourselves. Now, one thing that I always thought, and I think is very important, my first experience was with a Japanese Zen teacher, and he later fell upon ill repute, but he was a brilliant guy, and he could talk about all the dharmas and everything else with incredible insight. But when I met with him face to face, he was, trying to control my language here, he was a one-up bastard. You know, he made me feel extremely uncomfortable, and my experience was that he was looking down at me. So because of that, I took that in, and one of the things that I feel for students in the student-teacher relationship is that the relationship, even though we have different functions, the relationship between student and teacher is one of equals. Just because somebody is enlightened, they have learned all these different things, they're still equal to the student, and the student brings their own gifts. So together, you know, we work to create a place so that the student can reveal themselves. So another way to look at the teacher is the teacher is a guide. The teacher has had certain experiences and has certain awarenesses. And so the teacher is there to guide the student. But that doesn't make the teacher better than the student. They just, again, have different roles. The student is there to reveal what they already have. And the teacher is there to guide that process. So the term Roshi, there's two terms. There's sensei, which I am. And then when I get old enough, there's a certain relationship, well, between development as a teacher and also as a certain age where, well, it's the age has to do with how long you've developed yourself as a teacher. So it's usually an older teacher that becomes a Roshi. But it means teacher. Sensei means teacher and Roshi means teacher. But the term Roshi, I think, is given as it's a demonstration of respect for all the years that the sensei has taught. Now, the other thing about the teacher is, just because you get Dharma transmission, it's not like, I'm a teacher. We all of us who become teachers have to learn how to do that. And it takes time. And it's not the same thing for every student. You know, it's how to become a teacher using skillful means so that I can be a teacher for this particular student in this way and another particular student in that way, and taking into time and place and temperament and maturity and personal circumstances. All of this is how do you learn to use all those things best so that you can serve a student. So that's part of the learning process. It's not just, even though there's this transmission to teach, there's not necessarily a transmission to how to teach. And of course, I would go back to Roshi and say, listen, what do I do with this or what do I do with that? So, you know, you're not just dumped out there in the world and you're on your own, brother. So just briefly, I know a lot of you know this, but just a couple of things in my relationship with Roshi Kennedy, in how this worked between us. Now, I, especially because of that first experience when I first put my toe in the water with Edo Roshi was his name, you know, I was pretty insecure to go into a room, sit down, and be face to face with the Zen master. And I think Roshi sensed that. So that container became a very safe place. He was very gentle. He was very kind. He would answer questions. And he slowly created a relationship with me where I learned to trust him. So he was supportive when I doubted myself. And sometimes, now in the lineage that I'm in, we do koan study. And koans are these little stories that for most people, when you read it, you have no idea what they're talking about. But the koan is pointing in a particular direction that is related to revealing ourselves. So part of the interaction with the teacher for me was I would be given a koan by the teacher, and I'd have to come back the next week and respond to this koan. And in the beginning, it's very awkward because we take up the koan in a particular way, and we have to give all that up to really understand or really connect to the koan. Sort of the beauty of it in retrospect is Roshi would allow me to come, and I would have my story to tell, you know, a very intellectual story about what this koan meant. And he would just sit there very kindly with sort of a little puzzled look on his face, a very slight puzzled look on his face. And I would realize, this, I'm going down the wrong track. But he would never say, how stupid can you be? Right? That kind of stuff doesn't happen. But he knew in that particular set of circumstances with my temperament and where I was with my practice to just be silent and let me tie myself into knots. There were other times where I would get so lost in my thinking, I would no longer be there with him, right? I'd be off in la-la land trying to figure this out. And he would reach over and he would grab me by the nose and twist my nose a little, very gently, calling me back. Now again, that would not take place with every student. A male teacher is not going to touch a woman and twist her nose. But, you know, us guys hanging out there, you're allowed to touch noses. So with that little tweak, I mean, I'm kidding a little, but that little tweak was a way of coming back to this moment. And he would also, and I've told this story before, but he would also allow me to be foolish without making any judgment. So one time I came in, and this is after I had been studying and passed any number of koans for a while. I came in with some story. I don't remember what the story was. But I went on for a couple of minutes. And he bends over like this, and he whispers, it's a metaphor. Right, so I had made this hard story out of something that was just a metaphor that was pointing towards something. But it's at one point I escaped and became a teacher on my own, standing on my own 2 feet. But he was, in his relationship with me, in that room that we would meet in, was creating a container for me specifically to reveal who I was, to relax and enough in a way that would allow me to reveal myself. And then he would ring the bell, and I would leave. And the next student would enter. And then his work would be to create a student for him or her to go through, which would be maybe very different from mine. But again, a container that would be supportive of the practice to reveal what we already are. You know, I started out with this conversation that I had with this guy, this young man, and how he was going to Darshan and how that worked with an Indian teacher. And that thought got me thinking about what is it to be a teacher? But in the end, there are many different ways to teach, right? I described how it works in the Zen tradition, and he gave me a brief description of how it worked in the Indian tradition. So there are many different traditions, Tibetan traditions and tantric traditions, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. And the way that teaching takes place may be similar, it may be different. But it's not one that's better than the other. As a student, as somebody who wants to take up this practice, you have to go out and almost in a sense interview teachers. You know, you sit here, for example, with a teacher, and you listen to what does the teacher have to say? And what am I feeling and thinking in my body? Do I feel like this is a container that I could continue this process? Well, that's what a student has to do. There's, you know, a certain amount of responsibility as a student or a prospective student to find a teacher that you feel comfortable with. And that may mean you go through several teachers. You know, it's not necessarily you the first time being. So I hope that was helpful in sort of bringing some light on what is the student-teacher relationship in Zen. So, thanks for listening.